How do our exposures influence our health? Is metabolomics a good fit for studying exposure's impacts? And what are the molecular links between maternal health and child health? These are a few of the topics I discuss in this episode of The Metabolomist with my guest, Léa Maître. Welcome to Season 5 of The Metabolomist podcast, where we dive into the communities that are transformed by metabolomics. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with scientists who not only use metabolomics, but who leverage it for the greater good. People who know that metabolomics is a tool that holds the promise of transforming our society, but who also understand that to deliver on that promise, metabolomics needs to be part of something greater. Projects, networks, infrastructures, they all form around a common goal and make use of the best tools at their disposal. So this year in the podcast, I talk to passionate people who build communities through any strategy, from grassroots movements to decades of networking. Join me to discover the creations of these community builders and how metabolomics is helping them advance their mission. Today, I'm very happy to welcome Léa Maître. Hello, Léa. Welcome.
Hi, Alice.
This is an opportunity for us to talk again about a topic that I find really, really interesting, that is exposomics. We started last year with an interview with Gary Miller. And this year, I wanted to talk with you, Léa, because I think your work has a lot of very interesting multi-omic studies combining exposome with omics and especially with metabolomics, which, of course, is the core of this podcast. But also because we're running to the last weeks towards a very big event for exposomics. So thank you for joining me on the podcast. And as I usually begin, I would like you to tell us a bit, of course, where you work, what your work is about, and also how you got to working in the field that you work in.
Great. I'm very excited to be part of this podcast. I've been following it, and it's an honor to be a speaker on it. My trajectory, so I'm now an assistant research professor at IS Global in Barcelona. So IS Global in Campus Mar, we are mainly environmental epidemiologists. But when I arrived in IS Global, it's been exactly 10 years this month. Mm-hmm. I was the outlier. I arrived as the person with background in metabolomic and a little bit of exposome as well. It was mm-hmm. the start. Yeah, when I arrived there, I was the expert in this new field that was being introduced to environmental epidemiologists. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of the Helix project, or at least yes. when the data were coming through from the fieldwork and lab work. Before that, I was at Imperial College London in Jeremy Nicholson and Elaine Holmes' lab. And that's where I learned about the field of metabolomics through my PhD.
So you learned in one of the leading labs at the time building the field. So that must have been an exciting time.
Yes. Yeah. I was there at the prime time. Mm-hmm. It was very exciting. Also, yeah, seeing the National Phenome Center being set up. So that was all very exciting times.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really interesting perspective you bring also of being the metabolomics person, joining a group that is focusing on what was starting to be exposomics, because I guess it's a relatively new field as well. And what I really liked about Helix, so the project that you mentioned and the paper that we will talk about, is really this integration of the different omics, but not just together, which is what we usually do, but also to integrate them with the exposome measured. Can you tell us about the context in which you apply those omics and exposome measures? So is there a specific disease context or state of life context where you do your research?
Yes. The start of the field of exposomic for our group is really to study the early life exposures. So pregnancy and childhood, these are years of higher vulnerability to the environment. We know, for example, in the pregnancy, that's when the environment primes the methylation of the fetus. And actually, when we started this field, there were already studies from the Dutch famine where we knew that the dietary dietary pattern of the mother can impact the methylation of the children and have lifelong consequences on the chronic disease outcome. And there's a lot of examples from the animal kingdom too on how environment during pregnancy prime the offspring for the metabolic disease. So that was the start. We wanted to study better at the biological imprint of the environment in pregnancy and that markers we could follow through childhood, because the exposome, it's the study of the cumulative exposure throughout the life course. But concretely, where do you start? We don't have data throughout the life course of individuals. So let's start the life course of young people, because it's shorter and more feasible to start with.
Yeah, it's really an interesting aspect that I didn't realize until reading the paper, that there is a difference in looking at the effect of the exposome in, let's say, young children versus older people who have accumulated both a lot of exposures and also exposures that you haven't really monitored over time, so you don't even know what they are. So this is one thing I wanted to discuss with you about the paper is, what are these measures of the exposome? Like, what are the things that one measures? And of course, like the paper we will discuss has a an author's list that is like half a page, as usually these papers do, because it takes a village to do this kind of studies. But so I guess you worked with different groups doing different types of exposome measures. Are there typical measures people would do today that are like the basic things you should look at? Or for, let's say, a metabolomics person who wants to start in that field, what would you recommend certain things to look at specifically?
Yeah, so at the start of Helix project, the vision by the PI, Martin Willeheid, was really to go beyond, okay, we say one exposure at a time, but even one class of exposure at a time. We didn't want to look just at chemicals or just at air pollution. So the idea was to cover multi-families of exposure, from the physical, social environment to the internal biological features. We had a big team, as you say, so expert in each field, expert in the urban environment, not just air pollution, but also how the streets were connected around the families' houses and the connectivity by bus, so walkability indexes, to chemical exposures. And here, chemical exposure, we did cover broad classes using targeted method, because at the time we still thought that it's important to have quantitative measurements of these chemicals for risk assessment. And we covered from pesticides, persistent pollutant, plasticizers, so both persistent and non-persistent. And then also at the individual level, we had detailed information on the lifestyle, from physical activity, dietary patterns, stress factors, social capital. We are often criticized by sociologists in the exposome that we forget about the most important determinant of health.
But could be considered a confounder, I guess.
In Helix, we did ask the families about the social capital, how supported they are, and detailed economic support as well. The most important exposures depends on the health outcome you're looking at.
Yeah. I guess it's like with omics, like you want to shoot as large as possible in order to figure out which ones really had an impact in your study. Yeah. It's always a difficult question. There is one measure that I found really interesting, because the last exposomic conference I was at, this was a big topic. It's geospatial methods. Can you say a word about what that is for people who don't know what geospatial methods are?
Yes, well, the way I usually explain it, because I'm not an expert, it's the science of mapping, making high-resolution maps. So layers of information that you can map at on the points on the map. So it's information that can come from satellites or survey from the city halls. So, for example, the city hall will provide information on the public transports or the land use. So, for example, how many facilities and what kind of facilities are present on certain streets. That's quite a high determinant of how walkable a place is. If you have lots of supermarkets and sport facilities around your house, you're more likely to walk to them and have access to them. I would say GIS, geographical information system, it's the art of maps that you layer information on top of each other.
Thank you. Great. So I think we're ready now. We've set the stage a little bit and we can really look at the paper more specifically. So for people listening at home or wherever you are, the paper is titled Multiomic Signatures of the Human Early Life Exposome. And you're the first author on this paper. It's from 2022, but I think it's such a really beautiful example of what can be done with all those omics that this is really why we chose to still talk about that paper, even though your research has progressed and you've done many other things since. But it was really, I think, a landmark paper for you, but also for the community to really see how omics work well with exposome measures. So can you tell us a bit about the study design? I know, so Helix is a project that was covering six countries in the EU, I think. Can you tell us a bit, especially you looked at mothers and children. So how did you study them? How did you monitor them? How often did you meet with them or collect samples from them?
Yes. So the study design, it was really an idea from the PI, Martin Wieheit, where at the time they were already working with birth cohorts across Europe and starting to harmonize and cataloging the different cohorts across Europe. And they selected six of these cohorts where the children were around the same age. So they could really do a deep exposome phenotyping, organizing a new follow-up visit of these children at the same time with a harmonized protocol in terms of how to capture the external exposome with sensors. For example, all the children wore sensors, but also the biological sample collection to harmonize this, which is very important for the omics, and send it to the same labs, not to have batch effect from different labs. So that was the idea, to select six of this cohort, 200 families per cohort, where we do a deep phenotyping and exposome screening. So this one of the other conditions to be part of the Helix study was to have a biobank with samples from the pregnancy. So the idea is that we would organize a new follow-up of the children, but we would have access to samples from their mothers when they were pregnant. So that would be back from an average of 8 years before. So we could do an exposome assessment in terms of chemical exposure back in the mother samples and in the childhood samples. So we had two time points of exposures.
That's a really clever design, actually. Use what's there, but you can start there and then look at what happened a few years later. So what would you say were the main outcomes of this? Because I know for me, it's really impressive to see how well the exposome and the other omics fit together and the associations that you found there. Was that the main outcome for you, or did you expect that and you were looking for a specific thing?
When we combined all the data together, and that was millions of models, because we had all the exposures at two time points, so twice 100 exposures that were carefully curated, then the outcomes were all the omics features from methylation, transcriptomic, proteins, metabolites in urine and blood.
Yes, I should have mentioned also microRNA, like these are all the omics that were measured
also
there.
Also microRNA. So in total, we had 500,000 omics features. The bulk of it were the methylation because that was genome-wide. And we looked at pairwise association between all the exposure and all the omics. I'm co-first author for this paper with Mariona Bustamante, who was really bringing the expertise from genomic and methylation. And I was bringing more the expertise from the metabolomic perspective. I think one person couldn't interpret these results. Yeah. And the outcome, actually the first outcome when we crunched all this data, we thought we need positive controls. What do we expect to find? In Spanish, you would say COC, yes or yes, you need to find that to make sure your statistical models work and pick it up. And I thought, well, for the children with the metabolomic data, we know from past studies, we should find some association between the heavy metals, arsenic, mercury, with fish intake biomarkers. And in metabolomic, that is TMAO, I had found in my PhD another metabolite called homarin. That's from seafood consumption. So we knew we had to find this association out of the millions of models. This had to come up and pass the statistical threshold. And we did. So the top association of all these models were arsenic and TMAO. So we thought, okay, that works. The model works.
This is really,
questionnaires or
really important. Yeah.
Metabolomic work. Then the other positive control we had to find was the association between prenatal smoking exposure, tobacco smoking, the active and passive smoking during pregnancy, with methylation markers. And we did. There were already at the time the cataloging of methylation association was much more advanced than in the metabolomic community. So we used all these methylation catalogs, EWAS catalog, to check, okay, what are the top exposure association with methylation, and do we find that in our study? So that was a good confirmation. And then we had surprises, of course.
There's one thing that half surprised me. It was looking at overall what each omic brings, because you often get this question when you do multi-omics. It's like, is it just putting one omic next to each other, or is there an added value, and which one is more interesting or more relevant? And the feeling I got looking at especially figure two, where you see all the associations with all the different omics, is that even though the methylation, of course, covers a lot more features than, let's say, metabolomics, for example, proportionally speaking, there were many associations with metabolomics compared to methylation. Was that also your takeaway?
Yeah, so it depends on the timing. So our takeaway is that methylation as a omic layer is a better record of past exposure and probably better of prenatal exposures. Maybe it's a better memory of that vulnerable period. So most of the prenatal exposure markers were from the methylation. And metabolomic was the better omic to measure cross association. So when we measured the exposure and the omics at the same time in childhood, that's where metabolomic was the strongest. So maybe to capture like co-sources of these exposures.
Yeah.
And then there are some exposure, for example, the weather variables, ambient air temperature, humidity, ambient pressure. This type of meteorological variables, they were studied with all the omics in childhood. So that was quite interesting. That it depends also on exposure. Some exposure have more association with certain omics, and some would have a overall multi-omic effect that we can measure. I want to also say a disclaimer. When we say omics, they were not all covering the same breadth of the biological pathways. So, for example, when we say we did metabolomic, at the end, we did a targeted assay in blood and NMR, so semi-targeted in urine. We don't cover the whole biological pathways. And even methylation, yes, it was genome-wide, but at the end, you do methylation in blood. It's in the white blood cells, so immune cells. That's not the methylation of the whole organism. It's still, it's omics, it's white breast, but at the end, you're still measuring a certain part of the biological
always
layer.
This is always something to remind either young scientists or people who are new to omics, that I think it's my opinion, like, because omics started with genomics, and we got the feeling from genomics that we're covering every single possible base, that every omic does this, but most omics actually don't. So most omics, either because of the technical limitation, look at a fraction of the biology. Sometimes you have to prepare samples and separate based on physical chemical properties, and you know you're going to look at this and not that. There are many reasons why in the end we know we're looking at one fraction of biology. And I think the most important thing is exactly as you did it, is like to remind people of this, and also to know it when you do your own interpretation. So you know the limitations of your tools, and then you know exactly in which part of the field you can play, and then you can start to have fun. And then in the paper, you go and start building networks and looking at associations across the different omics. So this is, for me, a really interesting question for any multi-omic paper. did you find added value to having different omics? Or like if you could do it again and you wanted to save some money, would you only measure one thing? I expect I know the answer to that question, but let's see.
It depends on the biological question. Several omics layers are good, maybe not all of them. So for example, if the interest is to study immune response, which we published a paper last year with a team in INSERM, Grenoble, we then selected some omics layers. So for example, to study the immune response to the exposome, here we didn't include metabolomic. I thought it didn't make much sense. The type of metabolites we had measured were not so related to immune response. So we selected more methylation, the proteins, the cytokines, and the cell counts. And that was the best representation we had of immune response.
But maybe a few years later, you would consider measuring lipidomics.
Yes, of course.
As the knowledge evolves, then you also change the perception you have of the different omics and what they can bring. I think this is the really fascinating thing in the field. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, of course, the eicosanoids or like the other metabolites related to the immune response. But with what we had, the data we had, we didn't have the relevant metabolites. For example, other papers more focused on we had a paper on Mediterranean diet and ultra-processed food. Then the metabolomics we had was very relevant to better refine the dietary intake of a population.
But I found it really interesting in this study that all the omic layers had like showed some response, for example, to the meteorological circumstance. So I think this is my view, at least, that especially for omics that move. That was also an interesting thing that you didn't include genomics in that study. I can think of a reason why, but can you explain why there is no genomics in this paper?
Well, we wanted to look at biological imprint of the exposure, and we selected omics that are most likely to change. But we did have genome data afterwards, later in the project in these children, and there are papers using the genome afterwards. Some part of the genome can change with environmental exposures, but that was not the primary question.
Sure, but I think it really depends on the interpretation you're trying to make or the questions you're trying to answer. I think it's the beauty of all the omics that you chose there, that they are flexible, they are changing based on the environment. That's exactly why they're interesting here. Maybe to conclude on that paper, I mean, there would be so many things to say, but I always like to ask the guests if there was something that was particularly difficult in that study. So, I mean, it could be like getting the money or things like this, but maybe you were not involved at those stages yet, but still like coordinating things, doing the analysis. Like, is there something that comes to mind that was a challenge and that you learned to solve there and where you want to share?
Yeah, what was difficult was to summarize the result, like to pick what are we going to talk about. We had 1,000 hits, so had to make sense of it, had to visualize it, had to make a story out of it, and it took us more than 2 years.
Wow. And this, you worked with your co-first author together on this?
Yeah. And actually, so Mariona is a geneticist from background, and I'm more coming from metabolomics. So we're not environmental science experts. We also had to learn ourselves, like, okay, does it make sense to focus the narrative on that exposure? And we kept going back, like, okay, was that exposure well measured? Like, or also, are these markers robust across? Okay, we adjusted for confounders, but the confounding structure can be quite strong, and maybe you can't just adjust for example, fish intake. How do we, for example, the TMAO and arsenic association, is that really just because of the similar source of this metabolites, or there is something else? And I think there was something else, because it was such a strong association that also the gut microbiome played a role there. And we have a follow-up paper now with toxicologists to test that. So yeah, the tricky part was interpretation and making sure these findings were robust. And because epidemiologists at them, that's what they were used to. They would focus on papers on one type of environmentalization and one type of outcome. And they would try many stratification of models to discard any confounding. But here, when you have 1,000 associations, you can't do this for every single association. So we had to come up with some smart way to test. Or for example, BMI of the children that was strongly affecting the association with between the lipids and the persistent chemicals. So what was the conclusion from that? So we spent a lot of time interpreting the results.
Sounds like a lot of work, but it also sounds like a lot of fun. I would like to also spend a few minutes on maybe the follow-up work that you're doing now. So you stayed in that field of looking at the health of mothers and the health of children using omic tools. So what are your special focuses at the moment? Maybe some projects coming up that you want to mention?
Well, you just mentioned the health of the mothers, the health of the children. Well, up to then, we only focus on the health of the children. So these birth cohorts, they've been designed to look at longitudinal exposure and the impact on child health. And recently, I've been very interested in different aspects of child health, but in particular, neurodevelopment and mental health of the children. So that was the past few years, and looking at markers during the pregnancy of future neurodevelopment of the children. Mm-hmm. And looking at this, I realized, okay, but we're not looking at the health of the mother. And that's a huge determinant of the child health, in particular when you think of mental health of the child. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at neurodevelopment, for example, I have a paper on the exposome and neurodevelopment in the Helix children. And one of the strongest determinants is prenatal smoking. So tobacco smoking during pregnancy increase the risk of behavioral problems in the child. That's very strong results across several cohorts. And when I saw this result, I thought, but how do you disentangle the mental health or stress factor of the mother from smoking or
very
addictive behaviors that may be passed on to the child? Because, for example, prenatal smoking is also associated with child BMI and obesity issues. But how do you disentangle the addictive personality that can be passed on from the mom and the dad, so from the parents to the child? So also we have to study as well the maternal health and maternal mental health. Mm-hmm. And maybe when we look at the environmental factors affecting the child, to look at both how they affect the mother and the child. Here, I keep talking about the mothers. Fathers are also very important, but because we, in this birth code, we mainly collected samples from the mothers, we've been focusing on the mothers. So one of the latest projects we're finishing now was on the steroid metabolome during pregnancy and looking at neurosteroids in particular. And originally, the idea came from my PhD. So some neurosteroids derived from progesterone during pregnancy have been associated with child health, but at the time, there were no human studies really. Like there were some theoretical models that was associated in mothers with addiction, that they were protecting the fetal brain, but these were very small panel study. So I thought, okay, we have a great opportunity here in our cohort. We have longitudinal data in the children up to adolescence, and we still have these pregnancy samples. So we can do studies over 15 years on how the prenatal metabolism, in particular to steroid hormones, can affect the neurodevelopment of the children. And we do find, we found some association with some metabolites related to cortisol. And that was very interesting because the same metabolite now we're seeing that is also associated with the mother mental health postpartum. And now mixing different cohorts, we have also now a more recent cohort in Barcelona. It's called the BISC cohort, where we can validate findings. It's quite nice. where they have slightly more detailed outcome in the children, or different way to collect the sample that's a bit better than the older cohort from 15, 20 years ago. So now, our more recent paper, we're focusing on that.
And it's really interesting also because as you were explaining the detail of it, I was thinking, so in the paper we discussed before, like you kind of expanded your network or your fields of collaboration to environmental exposome research. And now it seems like you're turning more towards, or like in addition to that, to psychological, social science that combines together, really gives you the full impact on the health of both the mothers and the children. It's really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually takes us nicely to one of the last points I wanted to discuss with you, because in this season, we want to focus on community builders. And so how people who use metabolomics contribute to communities with the metabolomics tools that they bring. So I think you're a beautiful example of this. As you said at the beginning, you joined the team as the metabolomics person. And then we see through the paper and many other projects that it's been one of the building blocks of very strong households that are built, like becoming bigger and really involve a lot of different fields and disciplines. So what has been your experience of this community building? Because you were, I think, in the heart of one of the main places where the exposome field has been growing. How has this been like for you?
Yeah, it's been very interesting to be the link between the labs and the epidemiology, statistician, and also the scientists that had been looking more at air pollution or external factor. And the exposomic community is still quite diverse. So we knew we have to work together and we have common conferences, but it's still quite a challenge to all work together towards really assessing the exposome as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've been building communities through very structured projects. So both in the US and in Europe, there've been initiatives to create a community. So in Europe, for example, we had the project IHEN, the International Human Exposome Network. So that's a coordinated action. We are in the third year of the project. Mm-hmm. And in this network, for example, it's very interesting because we have people working from, they're coming from toxicology, from the epidemiology, and also from the infrastructure point of view. There've been a lot going on with IRIN and some labs in Czech Republic. So basically now, we know of each other, at least. We know who to ask when we need some more lab work or some more GIS modeling. And some of the institution can offer everything, but that's quite rare to have in-house all these specialties. The idea is to map in Europe and in the US, who should we go to for this expertise? And that people are aware when they build a study, when they build a cohort, where they get the different expertise. And I think actually now talking about it, I realize cohort is the common platform for everyone, because cohort is the start to have the samples, to have the individual, to have the health outcome measure. You need to have large cohorts and very good biobanks to start to do exposome. So the PIs of the cohort are very important in this aspect, because they bring this different expertise on the cohort. Mm-hmm.
And I guess more and more these cohorts, when they start to be formed, they include more and more measures of the exposome, which maybe 20 years ago were missing or almost non-existent. And now it's probably growing much more so that you have all that information from the get-go.
Yeah, actually, when I think about the UK Biobank, for example, so some of these cohorts were designed to look at genetic determinants, and now they think, oh, actually, I should have added exposure, which are very important determinants of health, and they're doing it a posteriori, enriching the genetic cohort.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of thinking about it after, also for people who build cohorts now and want to do metabolomics later, don't just prepare your samples based on wanting to measure genetics, like try to to collect at times where you can have like a more or less coordinated fast in time and not too long time to freezing the sample so that it can be used for proteomics, for metabolomics, and so on. But these are the things that the community learns over time.
Yeah. If I can add also on this aspect of sample collection, what's the protocol we've built in exposome research, it's also related to the urine. The urine sample is still very important to measure non-persistent exposures and even diet-related compound and microbiome compound. Some things cannot be detected in blood. You have to look at urine. And to correctly collect the urine because of this transient metabolite, you should collect repeated urine. So in our cohort, we ask the participant to bring at least day and night urine for 5 days that we pool and then analyze this weekly pooled urine. And we found that's a much better exposure assessment than a spot urine, even morning spot. So
very interesting. Thanks. And so as we launch that episode, we'll be 2 to 3 weeks away from the Global Exposome Summit, which is organized near Barcelona. So I think IS Global is a big contributor to the organization. So do you want to maybe say a few words both about maybe like what it means maybe to be the organizer this year and also just about that community in general?
Yes, so the Global Exposome Summit, it's really the peak of the IHEN project, but together with the American community, the Nexus, where we want to bring the Exposome didn't have really a big conference for its community. So, the idea is to bring the different parts of the community together. And also, as part of IHEN, we really wanted to bring Exposome to parts of the world that were not focused on Exposome or were not organized. So, for example, in Asia or South America, they have cohorts and they have environmental focused studies, but they're not necessarily linked with each other or they don't have a hub in their region. So we really wanted to see what were the needs of different global regions and help them if we could to build their own community. And that we've been doing through an ambassador program. And these ambassadors are really helping also with the organization of the summit to be able to reflect what can be done and what are the needs of other regions of the world. Because, we always study determinants of health where it's not the most needed in Europe and US. And we leave out other regions of the world where, for example, if you think in South America, all the mining and all the chemical exposure that they don't have necessarily resources to study or the expertise, connect also within these regions and helping them.
Is there a place where people can learn about that ambassador program? Like a link that we can put on the page of the episode, maybe, that people can learn more about it?
Yeah, well, in the website from the IHEN project, we have news about it. We're also inviting, for example, one very concrete way to bring this community together and maybe produce a better science by covering larger part of the world. It's this cohort catalog. That's my colleague Augusto is leading. So we're trying to reference and map all the cohorts in which exposome research can be done. So maybe this cohort, as I said, they were not designed to do exposome, but at the end, they've been adding layers of biobanking and environmental exposure. And now we're starting to have a very nice map for the whole world of cohorts to study that then can be used to screen for researchers. Okay, we want to study air pollution and blood pressure. Where can we do that in the world? Not just London and Los Angeles.
That's a great resource. Yeah, we'll also put a link to that. Thank you very much. I think we are at the time for our final and usual question. What is your favorite metabolite and why? Could you give it some thought?
Yes. Yeah, I would say throughout my career, I've been really interested in this neurosteroid metabolite. I think it's quite fascinating if we can measure in urine a metabolite that would affect the fetal brain, like if you measure a metabolite in the mother during pregnancy, and you, that can determine the child's fetal development. That's was one of my main research questions in the past years, and now with the result, we're having some surprises. That it's mainly some of the cortisol metabolites and not as much the progesterone metabolite that affect the child brain. But yeah, I find these steroid metabolites quite fascinating, and they're quite also good sensor of the endocrine disruptors' impact. There's been a lot of studies on endocrine disruptors, how they affect the risk of metabolic disease, obesity, diabetes. But people don't measure the impact on hormone directly, which I was quite surprised when I started this field. One of the reasons, for example, in females is that our hormone cycle is changing a lot throughout the months. So it's hard to study hormonal disruption in women. But in pregnancy, it's more stable. So that's where we started. We thought, at least in
there
pregnancy,
you go.
It doesn't matter which time of the month you are. There is a time of pregnancy, but it's a bit more easy to harmonize across a population. So yeah, I would say this hormonal perturbation are very interesting.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very interesting group of metabolites. Yes. Wonderful. Then I think we've reached the end of the episode. Thank you, Leah, for exchanging, for also teaching us a lot about exposome and also very efficient ways of collecting urine for exposome research. Thank you for that. And I look forward to seeing more of your research going out in the world, and also meeting you in person, I guess, in Barcelona or in Sitges for the Global Exposome Summit. Thank you very much for your participation in the podcast.
Thank you, Alice.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Metabolomist, where we explored one of the many communities that leverage metabolomics for the greater good. To make sure that you don't miss out on our next episode, you can follow the podcast on your podcast app or go to themetabolomist.com and register to our newsletter. Until then, I wish you to get to use metabolomics with the same passion and the same dedication as my guest today, and don't hesitate to reach out to me on LinkedIn at Alice Limonciel with your thoughts on today's episode.